The information presented in this podcast is not intended for the treatment or prevention of disease or any medical condition, nor is a substitute for medical advice. The information contained herein in this podcast reflects only the opinion of the author and presenter and is in no way considered required practice.
Welcome to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast that connects your brain to your brawn.
Hi, this is Eric Fiorello, and I want to welcome you to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast show that connects your brain to your brawn. And today is August 14th, 2014, and we are sponsored by Fiorello Barbell Company here in upstate New York, where we're not the biggest, but we're the best. And our motto is, we don't try, we succeed. And today we have the honor and another first-time guest on Motivation and Muscle. We have Bert Soren, who is president of SorenX, and he is partnered up with his dad, Richard Soren, who I'm sure anybody that knows anything about grip has heard of this gentleman. So I want to welcome Bert to the show, obviously, and today's topic, we're going to get in a little bit about Highland Games and recovery, and which ought to be a very interesting show. So Bert, welcome to Motivation and Muscle.
Eric, thanks a ton for having me, man. It's a pleasure to get to be on your show. I've listened to what you guys are doing and what you're doing as an athlete yourself, and it's truly an honor. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have you on. And you know, like I told you off air, we only live and do things with authentic people. And you know, I own equipment from your company, but just talking to you. You kind of get a feel for somebody, so we're glad to have you on. While we've got you, before we start on today's topics, why don't you give everybody out in Motivation and Muscle Land a little bit about yourself? Because, you know, you've been around for a long time, your dad's firm, and now you're more or less at the helm of it. But there are going to be people that probably don't know you, believe it or not. So you give us a little synopsis. If you want to talk a little bit about the company, you're welcome to do that too, Bert.
Sure. I appreciate it, Eric.
Sure.
Well, like I said, my name's Bert Soren. I'm 38 years old, or 37, I believe, at the time. Been in the iron game my whole life, and I have to thank my father, Richard Soren, for that opportunity. A lot of folks don't get to grow up around the iron game, and especially the iron game from an innovative side. Even from when I was a little kid, I'd go out into the garage. And SorenX was started in 1980 under the name Soren Equipment, where my father had been a coach and had built playground equipment for kids, and then got into building weightlifting equipment officially in 1980. Although he'd been doing it since the 60s when he was in his teenage years, when he was lifting up near York, Pennsylvania, and he's from New Jersey. So kind of an interesting history. But looking back to when I was a kid. Going in Dad's garage and where SorenX was started, some very humble grassroots beginnings on an innovative piece that we were trying to do. And the whole idea of it was there wasn't equipment out there that was strong enough, adjustable enough, had the right feel or had the quality of the look or the solution that he was looking for. So I have to commend him. At a time when racks and benches and barbells weren't as popular, because that was in the time of bodybuilding and the Nautilus kind of era, for him to step out and say, no, free weights and Olympic lifting and powerlifting is still where it's at, and started that company. And really, it was more of a lifestyle, really, than a company. We've kind of joked that we've been around 34 years, and we don't really have a job. We just get paid for our lives every couple weeks, which is kind of cool.
Yes, it is.
So anyway, that was what I grew up being around, in not only innovation in the equipment world, but being around the grip training and Highland game training and throws training and stuff like that, and having athletes and folks that I've read about now. I remember seeing them around the house or around our old gym when I was a kid. So I got a really neat opportunity for that I'll always be thankful for. And so that's kind of where I started. Fast forward 15 or 20 years to when I was in college at University of South Carolina, walked on as a track and field athlete, as a thrower, picked up the hammer, picked up the javelin, and through work that I don't know if I would be able to replicate these days anymore, ended up on my fifth year as a fifth-year senior. I think at that point I'd been a four-time All-American. I was a team captain and SEC record holder. So had a good career there and had some awesome teammates that helped push me and teach me really how to train hard and what it is to be a champion. From there, I went to into professional track and field for 5 years, where I competed in the 2000, the 2004 Olympic trials and the hammer throw. And then retired from the hammer in 2004 and quickly picked up the Highland Games in 2005 became the first world amateur champion in 2007, went pro in 2008 and competed on the circuit. So there's kind of my athletic background, interspersed with some powerlifting meets and some grip contests and some things like that. But that's kind of who I am as an athlete and how I got there.
Well, let me ask you this, Bert. Obviously, being around that type of activity, you know, since you're a young kid, I mean, that plays a big thing. But did you ever feel at any time, I mean, obviously, you know, the Highland Games, any type of track and field or anything. Here's a question which is real relevant now, because we know the growth of strongman and how big it is. Well, it seems bigger, obviously, over in Europe than the United States, but we've got some better athletes now than I think we ever have.
Sure.
I mean, with all the stuff you're around, did you ever contemplate anything like getting into strongman, or was it just a case of, you know, I don't end up wanting to be a 330-pound gargantuan guy that, you know, maybe can't even run to the end of the street? I mean, that's not with all of them, and I don't mean to single anybody out, but did you ever think about getting in anything like that? Or put it this way, or have you messed around with, I'm sure you played with stones and things like that, right?
Of course. I would have gotten more into the strongman had I just been a larger built person. I'm very skinny and tall just naturally. I graduated high school 6'2.5", 170. So I wasn't the largest guy, and that was during the time I was lifting a great deal as well. So I just wasn't built to be a big, thick person. So I was able to put on 60 pounds of body weight in college, but still I threw my lifetime best in the hammer at only a little over 230 pounds, which for a 6'3" athlete really isn't a big person. And that was eating an amazing amount of food.
Yep.
You know, the whole thing, just pretty much a hard gainer, you know? So I looked at the strongman and I looked at my levers, and it was, I wouldn't say it was an impossibility, but I think it was a bit of an impossibility based upon the level that I would want to have taken it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm wired nervous system wise, as well as my body structure is pretty good for throwing submaximal loads pretty quickly. Built
yep.
more for speed and power versus a strong grind out strength. The times
yep.
I've tried some strongman stuff, it just literally felt like my gears were grinding and stuff was going to start popping off of my body. I can't believe some of the things that you guys are able to do, because it's really, really hard on you.
Well, I can tell you, I've only really had one major injury when I was in Iceland in 2008 when we went on the tour. There was, you know, Steffi Peterson was in there, so he was in World's Strongest Man at the time. And Peter Grudmundsen, his brother, been involved in all that when Magnus Vermagnussen was real big, you know, in the 90s. Bill Crawford here from the United States, you know, he's a big Highland Games. He's up in New Hampshire. He's the one who organized the whole thing through Randy Strassen. But I know what you mean, the grind, because, you know, I tore my bicep, and that was, like, traumatic. It's fixed. It never had a problem. Knock on wood. We got back in 11, but we hit some weather when we shouldn't have been there, and that's a whole other story. So we're getting ready to try to get back here next spring. But you're right. It's like anything. It's very grueling on you. Especially you see that there's massive amounts of bicep injuries in that sport. Steffi had just had his bicep fixed. I think he was in a meet and they were flipping like a 1,000-pound tire and his bicep blew right off the bone. So I understand that totally. But I guess we all got, you know, like they said to me when I was like just so pissed, you know, one of the guys like, well, you got a permanent scar from Iceland now. I said, I look at it now and I'm like, yeah, you're right. And it's okay. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I look at it this way. You know, from Highland Games and anything else you've ever participated in, it takes balls to put yourself out there because, you know, it's always the I can'ts, it seems like, around you. You know, not everybody, but you meet up with a lot of that stuff. Well, why do you want to do that? Or, you know, you could kill yourself or you could, you know, get permanently hurt or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? You can slip in your bathtub and kill yourself, all right? The point I try to make with this stuff is this. We all like certain things. It might not agree with everybody or they don't understand it, but you know something? Unless you've gone out and thrown a hammer, or you've lifted a big sphere, or walked with a Husafell stone, or, you know, maybe squatted for the first time in your life 300 pounds, it's a big friggin' deal,
sure,
man. Sure. And it's like, unless you've done it, I don't know how to explain it to you because it's very hard. You'll connect with people to a point because, you know, let's face it, everybody likes the Rocky saga. We like the underdog. we want the Bert Sorin, the Eric Fiorello to go wherever they got to go. And, you know, no one sees you busting your can for the year up to you're getting ready to leave. They only usually see the end result. Either we make it or we don't.
Right.
And people can be very hard about that stuff with you, and you're like scratching their head. But what you know, especially talking to you today, being that you've been in this type of stuff, and especially with the equipment I want to hit on, and we were talking about recovery, it's like this stuff is some serious, serious juice you're playing with. And it's like I see people now in a different light where – I don't know if a lot of them have the wherewithal to do it. It's a certain thing. Now, you were obviously – we always say it's in our DNA. That's how I call it. You had the honor, at least your dad was an athlete, an equipment builder obviously. So he had that around you, which I'll tell you right there, you know, you're a pretty damn lucky guy, which you've already said. But for guys like me and everybody else, you know – we're coming up. We're trying to figure it out. You know, you try to attach to some older lifters, and if they don't beat your butt, you know, like in the gym or tell you to shove off, you know, you might get a shot with somebody that's, you know, done some things. But eventually you are going to have to branch out on your own, which I have found because I'm sure you've seen it too and been part of it. After a while, you start going through, like, lifting trainers, buddies, whatever right. You want to call them. And I got so on the other end of things with this Husafell saga that there was only really one guy, but he's moved down to South Carolina about 10 years ago, who was an Olympic lifter. So he was pretty set up to do a lot of that stuff when we started getting into this. But nobody else wanted to touch it. Nobody wanted to touch it. And I look at it two ways, because I had to kind of humble myself pretty good. And you know from lifting stones, if you've never done it, I don't care how strong you are, it's going to humble you initially. So a lot of guys couldn't get over that ego thing. But I used to get this from these guys, and these guys were established lifters. It was like, a stone, it's not going to do anything for you. You're not going to get bigger, stronger. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you frigging kidding me? So I guess the gist of this is this. Why do we do the things we do? You know, why do you go throw – why do I go lift these big, huge objects that could put me down into the earth permanently? And I guess the whole thing is I can't speak for you. It's almost like it's DNA. I'm telling you right now. My mother and father weren't lifters. My dad played ball. You know, he was an athlete and everything, but none of them ever, you know, I mean, they both skied, all that stuff. None of them, my father might have done a little bit of weights back in the day, but not like we do, you know, and it's like, so where did that come from, you know? And I say it's like ingrained in us where whatever touches it off,
right?
I don't know. So,
you
know,
it's kind of like a powder, like a mental powder keg in there. It just needs a spark. Yeah. And I definitely know I have that. And I think it was actually, you know, obviously DNA passed to me, but you know, you look at you have to have fertile soil too. And I think I was fortunate enough to have the fertile soil and the you know, being able to grow up around it. And I think I told someone else that since, I wanted to say my first double body deadlift was when I was in second or third grade. And the funny part about it, it was 112 pounds, which was, that was the double body deadlift. So I was 56 pounds. And so it's kind of funny that I even, A, that I remember that, and B, that I thought that was so neat. And I remember writing, we had a show and tell, and that they said, what was the, you know, the happiest, you know, thing that you did in your life? And I remember telling the class, it was the first time I deadlifted double body weight. So it's just, you know, you're around it. But I think the key is, like you said, if you're not around it that much and you don't have that perfect scenario, you gotta burn some gas and take up some time and make some friends and learn how to be social and learn how to add to the group. Because like you said, if you go into a gym that's maybe an older lifter that has seen it and done it all. I mean, I can't even imagine how many workout partners I've gone through in the last 30 years of doing this. But so if you're going to be a part of a group, you have to bring something to the table. Even if as a young lifter, if you walk into an established group, you need to bring something to the table. That could be something physical, like bring water, bring Gatorade, whatever that might be, or bring an attitude of being happy to be there, respect, support for the older guys, help wrap knees, help move equipment, help clean up, whatever it may be. Because like you said, you got to earn your bones, and you have to be giving something in kind. You can't just take from the Iron Game. You can't take from these guys that have trained 30, 40, 50 years. My father's deadlifted 500 pounds for 49 years straight.
That's awesome.
And then you said, we have young guys come into the gym and they want to train. I want to get strong. And yeah, you want to pour into them, and that's a part of giving back. They also have to learn that there's some blood and some skin in the game from them as well. I don't know if you know Desi or Dezobon or Dezo.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. Anthony DiTillo, brother.
Yeah, Desi was my dad's coach when he was a teenager.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Anthony DiTillo and my dad were workout partners at the old Elizabeth Y.
Can I tell you something? I don't want to interrupt you, but I got to tell you this. I've been a fan of DiTillo forever. When Bill Hinburn put the republishing out of his books and all that, because initially a buddy of mine, my friend Rich, who's the Olympic lifter, used to come over here and do the strongman stuff in the beginning. He's a lot older than me, but he had every issue of Iron Man, and I remember he'd bring the stuff over and says, you got to read this guy, DiTillo. And I can remember the pictures of him. Like Roger and I were talking about this the other day. There he is on that incline with over 400 pounds, and the thing which was so cool was not only was he mammoth, but you see those big monster chains like holding the rack together he's on, and I'm like, not only that, he had a way of writing, which was like, he was one of the best writers I think Perry Rader ever had. I mean, he had some great writers, but when I got all those books, just that, but I can remember pictures of him because, you know, I'm a big power rack guy because I pretty much train alone now. So everything I do is in the dead stop fashion, whether it's squats. Well, obviously, you know, a deadlift we pull off the floor, but if I pull, you know, if I want to do some holds, some ISO holds, whatever. And obviously I have a Viking press and I have, you know, I can dead stop right off the rods at any height. And I've got a thing for dumbbells that I built. So I remember a picture of DiTillo and I'll never forget it. And I think if you go out on Desi's site there, he's got all kinds of stuff in my show. I remember a picture of his upper back, his traps, man. They didn't even look like traps, dude. They looked like somebody with size 20 feet on each side. I was like, this guy's unreal. And then I remember, because he was a big power rack guy, too.
Sure.
I'm sure you read all about it. Remember when he cut down to like 180 and he did everything through a power rack? You know, every exercise, rep range, everything. And it was like, the guy was like, he was immortal, man. It was like, you talk about, I'm amazed, your dad, holy God. You talk about, see, you know what it is? Even though you're miles away from me and all these other guys I talk to and gals, it's like, we always find somebody where we connect.
Sure.
It's like, you know, holy God, Anthony DiTillo, you know, your father trained with his mentor, you know. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but go on about Desi and your dad. That was
well,
cool.
I mean, that, you know, we might just save that whole Desi
for another show.
For dad, get him on. Because,
yeah.
I mean,
okay.
You know, the tight tan slacks that Desi wore, I'll let dad tell you the rest of that story.
Okay.
And so, yeah, but you're right. The iron game is a lot smaller than you would think.
Yeah.
But just going back to, I don't even remember what our initial.
When we were when you said that, it came up. I don't know how that came up, but it came up. But you were talking about how your father, he was your father's coach, mentor.
Yeah. When dad got there in his, you know, teenage years, he had to, you know, Desi would train him. But he had to give to the group as well, because you looked, that was an all-star cast, and there was a bodybuilder who became somewhat well-known that also trained with him, a guy named Dave Draper.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was there later on, too. So,
sure.
So that was a pretty solid gym, if you think about it. So, but I'll save that for you to talk with
oh, that'd be great.
Those stories. He was first-hand account, so.
Well, you know something, too? You know, I've seen different film. I mean, as long as we're going to talk about bodybuilders, but I don't equate those guys to today at all. When you see a guy, now, we were a little kid. We were, I don't remember how old. Let me think. We were probably about 10 or 12 and 85 or 86. There was a gym here where I started out in my cellar like everybody else, started bigger in the cellar because I'm sure you remember this guy, Ed Jubenville, back in the day. We bought equipment from him, pretty raw, but it worked, you know. And we ended up going to a club called the Steel Pier Athletic Club, and they were pretty big back in the day. I think they're even nationally known, too. And I'll never forget this. I remember my one buddy, well, he was a lot older than us. He was a mentor, too. Craig Morrison, his name was. And he was competitive and all that. And I remember he had an old DVD, and it had, like, Arnold. They were talking about it. And I've heard Arnold talk about it years ago, that they'd train out in the woods, and, like, they showed a picture of him when he was, like, about 265. And it was kind of, you know, it was garbled, but you could tell it was him. I mean, he was bigger. He was smooth, but he was huge. And they show him, like, he was doing cheat curls with, like, 275 pounds. I mean, and what I'm getting at, like Dave Draper, too. And one guy that I thought was phenomenal, we saw him in person, was Sergio Oliva.
Right.
Now, anybody that knows anything about Sergio Oliva, he was an Olympic lifter in Cuba. I'll tell you this. To this day, now, he said he was in his best shape, and I think he said he was weighing around 250 at the time. This guy was mammoth. I know everybody will say, well, he's juiced and all. I don't care, man. His physique was not built on juice. But this guy was thick. And I know that, you know, they think, oh, you got a smaller waist, you know, you're weak. This guy was phenomenal. I mean, and the thing I'm getting to, like, when you're talking about Dave Draper, you know, part of that whole thing with your dad, and Arnold and Sergio, you know, you look at any of them. You know, I don't think Bill March was doing any of that stuff, but, you know, look at Grimmick and people like that. It was a different kind of lifter. Even if they did that bodybuilding, you know, you look back in the days of those shows, they were doing Olympic stuff. They were doing strongman stuff before those. So my perception and my look of those type of lifters is nothing like today. Nothing. Because, you know something? I'm one of those people that believe this. It's like anything you do with training, you know, number one, I like doing everything pretty much standing up. Do I think the bench is good? Yeah, I think the bench was good before it kind of got out of whack with everything. I like the old style. If I do anything, I do floor presses. So I'll set my rods at a specific height in the power rack. I'll get on the platform and I'll lay. I don't lay on a bench. That's the way I like to do it. But I like that standing up, doing everything. And I think that's the proper way to do things. And I think those guys back then, even though it was a different type of bodybuilding, I think they all subscribed to that. And those are the bodybuilders I really admire. I mean, I think it was just a different thing. And if you're training with the likes of Desi, I don't think you're going to be sitting there doing pump outs all day.
Yeah, like I said, I'll let Dad tell you about that.
Yeah, okay, that's good. But, go ahead. Go ahead.
What you're saying as far as, where bodybuilding has gone, I'm certainly not bashing bodybuilding, but to speak to what you're saying is, during that era, it was an era of physical culture. And
yes.
If you look back to the York picnics and things like that, where they'd have the national Olympic lifting championships, or just called weightlifting at the time, and after that, they might have a powerlifting exhibition and then a bodybuilding pose-off. So these are guys that were Olympic lifting shape doing pose-offs because it was just about being a strong person. And about what happens in any culture, you start getting specialists. And that was – it was the fledgling side type of the time of the physical culture. So – You had well-rounded strength athletes. It was just about being strong. And yeah. Now, the guys who were larger and more the guys who are just really, really strong but not fast, well, they became powerlifters. Well, the guys that were really powerful, they became Olympic lifters. The guys that were a little bit leaner and could show their abs, well, they became bodybuilders. So things started polarizing within the community. And of course, in today's world, you have championships and world championships for all of those different sports. So if you're going to be good, you have to specialize. And that's kind of the interesting part about it is you're not going to have an Olympic lifter anymore that's a great bodybuilder because they're just built differently. And where 50 yep. years ago, it was such a novel piece to have that physical culture and to lift weights in general. In the 1950s, it was just you were somewhat of a freak if you were lifting weights. So that was something that you could kind of be good at a lot of things. But unfortunately now, or fortunately, unfortunately, however you want to look at it, the folks at the highest level have gotten so specialized that you're almost becoming a one-trick pony. And that's where some of the folks that could pull off, like a Derek Poundstone being amazingly strong and strongman, could probably be very, very good at powerlifting, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
He doesn't look like he's very far out from being able to do some bodybuilding as well. Obviously, his core is thick because of all the heavy lifting. But folks like Pujanowski and stuff like that, but I don't know if you're going to go back to the days of your Bill March winning senior nationals, world championships, and then Mr. Universe right away.
Oh, yeah. He was incredible. Well, what I wanted to ask you, too, you see things about Poundstone every now and then. Is he pretty much out of the pro strongman arena? Because, he hasn't been in WSM, at least in 2 or 3 years now? Because I know he's had a lot of injuries, torn biceps,
right.
et cetera, et cetera. Do you know, I don't know if you have contact, but is he competitive anymore, or is he out?
I speak with him from time to time. He's one of our customers with his Poundstone Performance Center. On the outside, I don't want to speak for him. I don't know what
his career
is doing. I know he's still pushing some really heavy weight. I don't know if he's still training for very high competitive strongmen at the moment. I know his wife is pregnant and about to have their first child. I know he's running his business, so it looks like
is he still
like
a police officer too, Bert?
I believe he is. I think he has a lot of other things on his plate.
Yeah, definitely.
And it just from the outside looking, he's not a huge, huge person to start with, and I think that everything's just hard. It's just a hard row to hoe, the strong man, especially if you're not a Brian Shaw, a Hofthor, Bjornsson, those guys are just so big that load on their body and their skeletal system is a lower percentage of a guy like Poundstone or even like myself. You know, I competed for 20 years straight, whether it be high school track and field, college, professional, or Highland Games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I took a step at about 33, 34 and said, wait a minute. You know, I've competed for 20 years straight.
Right.
My body is tired. It's
yep.
beat up, banged up. I think I only had to get one surgery out of all of that. But you have nicks and bangs and bruises, and you know, as we all do.
Oh, absolutely.
But you kind of realize, or I did, that to be at a world-class level, which was my goal, that became more and more difficult in the sport that I chose. Now, it's not saying that I didn't keep up with a physical culture side, because I certainly still lift, and I enjoy, you know, doing. I've done a Highland game or two, but it's hard. And now again, I'm just guessing maybe what Poundstone and might be going through. I don't know. I can't
mm-hmm.
speak to his actual piece of it. But I came to a realization in my career that in order for me to reach the levels that I really, really wanted and had been before, I knew what the price tag of that was.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that price tag did not include at the time for me. That price tag included letting my business slip, that my business was growing and something that I'm trying to make an impact on the community, that I think we could bring a lot of great things to the community, but you have a shelf life with that, right?
Yep.
So I wanted to push that and to see, is while I'm in my prime for Sorenex, what can I do in the world of strength? That was one piece of it. A second piece was I was ready to have children.
Sure.
You know, and I had just recently gotten married, and I said, well, I've been somewhat selfish in my quest for strength and human performance for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a bit of a personal growth to how do I become more selfless and do something that I could pour into more. And when I started looking at the price tag and how all that came out, I said, if I'm putting X number of effort into my family, X number of effort into my business, other social requirements, things like that, I don't feel that I have a very good chance of being world class anymore at the sport that I've chosen. So mm-hmm. I kind of gracefully stepped down and said, "All right, guys, y'all have some fun. You know, I'm clocking out here for a while, maybe forever on the high end part of it." But I also had to look and say, "Well, if I did it for 20 years, and you know, I like you said, training in your basement, I trained out in a field by myself for 5 years.
Yeah,
and that was after working, you know, 50-hour work weeks running a company, and I would become a professional athlete at 5:30 p.m.
Yep.
And train without a coach, and to try to compete against the best in the world. I'm not saying a sob story, but you just have to be
realistic. No sob
story. Be realistic of what you're doing. You know, I wasn't training at the Olympic Training Center. I didn't have a coach. I didn't have a training group, and all the other things later in my career. And that's okay, but you have to be realistic of what are you really putting into it. And
right.
And I realized that was possible if I only lived training,
mm-hmm.
but that just wasn't the choice that I had made at that point. So how do I still be involved in it, help maybe more and have a bigger footprint on the industry that I did when I was competing? If I could sponsor athletes, help athletes, come up with innovative designs that help the next guy, like, say, safety straps on a power rack, if that helps Derek Poundstone from getting crushed, which I watched a video of him dumping 900 off of his back and it got caught by the safety straps. If use of my time can help others, then I could have a bigger impact than I ever could throwing 85 feet in the weight versus 82 feet in the weight.
I agree with you. And here's two things. I mean, number one, commendable. I know right where you've been, like a lot of us. I train outside. Got a garage. We got heat in the winter, not real warm. I've done idiotic stuff where it'll be 10 below and I'll take my shirt off like they'll do in Iceland to carry to Husafell, which really is the way you should do it. Now, you know what happens when you take a stone when you're sweating and it goes against your skin, right? Well, I leave my skin on the stone, okay?
Oh.
So Look, here's the thing. You know, most people don't have the luxury or the money to hire a coach or be involved with a group, okay?
Right.
So this is what I believe, Bert. I think if you have the mental tenacity, if you're hungry, and you got to be hungrier than anything.
Yep.
You can do it. You've done it. I've done it. A lot of others have done it. But you have to have that mental hunger that it's very hard to find people that have that. There's a lot of people that oppose it. You know, they come in, you see them, they're screaming and they're whacking each other all over and this and that. And then they'll go up to pull the bar or whatever, and they choke out, you know?
Right.
Look, I like the idea. I train alone pretty much all the time now. And like I said, the power rack is my best friend out there because it's the only thing that can save my life if something should happen. So I think training by yourself really prepares you for a lot of what's going on out in the field when you are technically by yourself. All right, you got people pushing you and you got people doing the same thing. But when it comes down to it, it's you.
Yep.
Period.
That's
all right.
Your, that's really your only competition is you. That's
exactly
what it comes down to.
Exactly. And I've always liked this side of it. And this is what we're trying to really put this message out to people, but you're not alone. You know, you've got guys like you that I'm sure if somebody had to ask you a question or get to you, I know you would answer. It's the same like Roger or any of these guys that are involved with this whole podcast thing we're doing. It's like, you know, yeah, I want you to go out and make your mistakes and, you know, maybe you got to go out and freeze your butt off for a few months to get ready, right? But on the other thing, it is nice to have somebody that maybe's done it a little bit, like, you know, Highland Games. But you've been around all the other stuff, too. And my thing, what I always do now more than ever, it's like you talked about we want to help people. That's exactly it. I'm not saying you got to carry their water for them. But you know something? If an 18-year-old kid comes to you, or you're watching this kid and his squatting is horrible, all right? And this kid, you see him in there, he's a worker, but he's just kind of lost. You know something? I would walk right up to the kid, and unless he's some little wise shit, you know, I'd say, look, you know, let me help you out here, because that's at least something you can leave somebody.
Right.
You know, I think, too, you know, my mother's has always said this to me as a kid, and I never forgot it. And I know, you know, some people are like, what, you know, but I'll tell you what. She used to always say to me this. You can say hello or smile at somebody because that might be the only kind thing a person gets that day.
That's it.
All right? That's important, man, because I've had people come over to me, you know, people, strangers say hello, and maybe you're out, you know, you're thinking about stuff or you got business on your head, and it's like, hey, hello. You know, it's like it stops you, man. It kind of makes you refocus and, you know, you got a lot of kids out there, and you know, all different ages that want to do things physical, but they don't know how. And I'm not saying I know everything because I don't, but I've been around this stuff long enough where if you ask me how to do something like that, basic, how to lift this, that, I can show you how to do it if you want to learn it, you know?
Right.
So I think that's real important. And one other thing I want to say, you know, when we were talking about Derek Poundstone, my opinion is, and you can take this either way, I think as long as the Drunas is still playing, I know Shaw won the 1 year, you know, the year before, but unless he drops out or anything, I'm gonna be very surprised if I still think he's pretty much unbeatable if he wants to be. I really do.
Z is one of those athletes that, I mean, I love Brian, I love Derek. I mean, those
yep.
are awesome guys, good friends.
Yep.
Z is one of the only guys I've ever seen that. I hate to say it, he's almost like Ivan Drago from Rocky.
Yeah.
He's literally a machine. Like,
yep.
And I've had these talks with Terry Todd, and it's honestly comical that I don't believe I've ever seen him miss a weight,
no.
ever. And it's this weird hydraulic gear he has where whatever the weight is, it goes up usually in the same fashion and the same speed and the same tempo with the seemingly same effort,
mm-hmm.
no matter what weight it is. And it's always whatever is needed to win. And it's, we kind of laugh. It's like, you know, someone can deadlift 1,100 pounds and the house comes down, and then you watch Z and he kind of goes, okay, I'll take 1,105. And
yep.
And you go, is he going to make it? And you just know he is. You know yeah. he is. And it makes you kind of wonder, what does he do in training? And,
yeah.
and is his are his training numbers so much higher that he just does whatever it takes to win in competition? Or is he so mentally strong that whatever it takes, is it a binary thing? Is it off or on?
Yeah.
When that switch flips,
yep.
it's just going. And it, just like a hydraulic, like a forklift or something. And you watch it, and it's just absolutely mind-boggling. Because if you look, the only times he really gets beat are if it's a speed-oriented event that has
mm-hmm.
you know X number of reps and X number of time or whatever it may be, which – you know, that's not a mindset or a failure thing. It's just, okay, that guy did it faster than I did.
Right.
You know,
right.
but if it's ever, you know, who can pick up this piece
right.
of equipment, it's really hard to bet against Z because I've never seen him ever fail, ever.
Well, he's like raw power. I mean, you see him, and you know the thing is, he's not the prototype, you know, like, what do I want to say, I had his name right on my mind. What the heck? You know, he won probably four or five World's Strongest Man. I can't think. He went to an MMA fighter.
Pujanowski.
He doesn't have that bodybuilder's body. I mean, looks like a big dude. And, you know, it made me laugh when he said, like, you know, he'll beat him by a point or 5 pounds. You know what that reminds me of? And I always loved this dude as a lifter, and I think he was one of the most massive people I ever saw, besides like a Paul Anderson or one of these guys. Serge Redding, you remember?
Yeah.
Alexia would come up and beat him with 5 pounds, man.
Yeah.
And I've gone back and tried to get all the video I can of like that, and they had some of it on the old Wide World of Sports
sure.
and all that, because But I'll tell you what, you know, I got pictures. I mean, you look at Redding, man, and Alexia was big. But look at the legs on Redding.
He's enormous.
He's huge, man, and his upper body. I mean, I've got pictures of him, like, you know, doing high pulls and stuff. And I'm like, you know, I guess it was just the luck of the draw. You know, it was like Alexia was always a little bit better.
Right.
You know, just a little. You know, and. You know, I was like, damn, man, you know, just once, but it's like everything, you know, Zydrunas walks on and it's like, okay, what's he going to do today, you know? And it's like, and it's not just WSM. He goes in these other meets in Europe. And like, I think I read a thing, it might've been in Milo. Maybe it was the last issue or the one before. And I think he said he'll retire after he can press 500 over his head.
Right.
Let me tell you, man, that's insane.
Well,
and, you know, it'll be with a log, obviously. And it's like, that's why I say, you know, you got a guy like that, and, you know, he's no kid either. I mean, he's in his mid, he's approaching his latter 30s now. I mean, at least for lifting, they tell you you're finished. I guess it's up to you at that point. But, I mean, there's a guy that, you know, if you look at statistics and everything, he shouldn't be doing that stuff now, at least not year after year after year. I just see the guy, he's better. You know, and I love watching him. I mean, I like watching all those guys, but it's like I still think unless he fails mentally or has a major injury, I think he can go. I think he's got another good year in him if he wants to do it, at least.
Yeah,
maybe two.
I agree. I think he's one of those athletes that was, you know, the great. There's always the you know, the dynasty. You know, that could have been Arnold in his day, and it was a
yeah.
lot of the same thing. It wasn't necessarily that he was physically better, different, whatever. You know, there was obviously he was ready to go, but you know, you watch Pumping Iron and just know more
yeah.
about Arnold. It was the stuff between his ears that made him so amazing. But you look at the same thing of like you said, Alexiev almost always beat Redding, and Redding
yeah.
was stronger.
Yeah,
but Alexiev was a great competitor. You look at another great duo in the Russian system that's less well known is Sergey Litvinov and Yuri Sedek, the two hammer throwers,
yep,
from the Russian system. Those were the two best guys in the world, pretty much hands down at any time. They broke world records back and forth, and it was literally just who showed up that day.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was crazy. And I've had an opportunity to talk with Sedek, and you know, just an amazing competitor. And it's a really fun, a quick story, but it reminds me when you were saying how a lot of guys are walking around and huffing and puffing and doing all this, mm-hmm, yelling and screaming and whacking themselves on the face and all this other stuff, which is, it's all real fun when you're like 20 and you think,
yeah,
that's what you're supposed to do, and you see other guys,
yeah,
do it. And then you grow up and you maybe mature a little bit and you've had some success, and then you realize that that's what all the guys were doing that didn't know what they were doing. You know, and I've trained with Donnie Thompson, and that's the calmest dude you've ever seen before he puts 1,200 pounds on his back. And he's having a,
yep,
conversation with you and all this other,
yep,
stuff. And then he goes, "Hey, Hammer, will you help wrap my knees on this one, bud?" "Yeah, mm-hmm, sure." "Okay." And the countenance never changes. It's, "Hey, let's just do this." "Okay, well, I'm going to get under the bar with this one. Make sure I'm set up right." And you're thinking, wow, you're about to squat the most that any human's ever squatted.
Yep.
And, you know, the music's loud, but that's usually because there's other people in the gym that want it. And he's telling me, he's like, "I don't care if the music's on or not." You,
right,
know, everything's going on between his ears. But going back to Sedek, there's an old story how Judd Logan, another great athlete, four-time Olympian in the hammer, American, probably one of the better coaches I've ever met as well, good friend, but awesome guy. And Judd, the story goes that Judd went to Sedek's hotel room. Now, this is back in the 80s when the Russians and the Americans didn't get along too well, which is funny in itself. So he went over there and he goes, "I got to see what this guy does before competition." So he sits down there with a pad and paper and watches. And he's, you know, it goes something like 7 o'clock, Yuri smokes a cigarette. 7:05, Yuri drinks a cup of coffee. 7:15, Yuri eats white toast. 7:30, Yuri smokes a cigarette. Like, it goes on like this for hours.
Yeah.
And they get to the competition, and Yuri sits there under a tree smoking a cigarette. And Judd's freaking out because, you know, Judd's a big lifter, and he's like getting all fired up and psyched up. And Yuri walks out there and just kind of very, very, very relaxed. And all the Americans are jumping up and down and doing all these drills and all this stuff, slapping each other. Yuri walks up, first throw, field record, you know, mm-hmm, crushes everybody by meters and goes, sits back down.
Mm-hmm.
And Yuri told me about this. He laughed. He said, "Well, first of all, with all the nicotine, the caffeine and the sugar," he goes, "well, I didn't want to do anything to interfere with the stimulants because I was jacked out of my mind, you know, first of,
yeah,
all." And he said, secondly, he said the whole time, he said, "It's like a bottle. It's like a,
yeah,
a bottle of emotion and of excitement." He said, "And all I was doing that whole time under that tree is trying to hold the cap on that bottle." He goes, "I was,
mm-hmm,
taking more energy to hold that cap on the bottle." He said, "because emotions are like a match. You could strike,
yep,
them, they'll burn real hot, and then they dwindle down into a small flame, and then they go out." He said, "all of,
yep,
those guys getting ready for the competition burned their match before we even stepped in the ring." And he says, he goes, "but I would keep it in. I'd use all my energy to hold in that energy and that emotion." And he said, "the first throw, I would come out of the gate, and I would throw everything down on that first throw." And he said, "I would usually throw my best throw of the day on the first one." He said, "and when you do that in a competition, everyone craps their pants and you just..." And it was like, wow, what an amazing,
yeah,
really
story.
I mean, what a great strategy. And,
yeah,
and that was it. He goes, "I could very rarely ever replicate that best throw off that first one because that was my time to strike." Where as a thrower, I know a lot of our strategy was, you know, you get your safety throw in like you do in a meet. You squat 100 pounds,
mm-hmm,
under what you're going to do, get in the meet, you know.
Yep.
And then you work your way up. And his whole thing was, "no, I'm going to break the American record on the first throw and make everyone pretty much crap, and then I'm going to sit down and let them fight for second."
Well, that's the beauty of it. And you think today's standards, I mean, to see an athlete smoke, and they'd probably put them in jail now. You know, I mean, it's like, look, the whole thing is, and this is strikes another point, it's the will.
Of
It is your will. When you will yourself, what's going to stop you? You know, and, you know, look, it. I'm not one to tell you, you know, eat all the crap in the world you want or smoke or stay out all night. But I'll tell you what. I mean, when you're getting in your mid to late 30s, maybe 40s, you better, if you're still around and you're still relevant, you know, you might want to maybe curtail some of that. But I also think, too, you know, let's hark back to, like, you know, Jack Dempsey, any of the real good fighters. I mean, you know, those guys lived a very harsh life. I mean, most of those guys smoked. They drank like crazy. And, you know, they were out all night, a lot of them. But, you know, then they'd be ready to fight like dogs in Yankee Stadium on a 105-degree day, you know, and they weren't just fighting like 10 rounds, 12 rounds, whatever. I mean, these guys be out there all friggin' day, it seemed like. Right. And, you know, I don't want to say today it's softer, but I will say that in a lot of ways. I think that I'm not saying you need hardship where something serious happens to you, but you need to get knocked back on your heels maybe 10,000 times, and then you know, you have that fight in you, that will in you, to let you know, you got to put your time in, you got to work hard, you got to try to eat well, obviously sleep well. Those are all big factors, but the main thing is this: in any endeavor, like, you know, whether you're in the Highland Games, strongman, bodybuilding, powerlifting, et cetera, you got to put the time in the gym or whatever you're doing, all right? And I don't know. I don't know now. I think it's out there, but I think a lot of people think, you know, I can do the bare minimum and get by. Well, maybe some athletes can, but the majority of us can't.
Right.
And if you go in with that idea, you're failing, man.
Right, right. And I agree with you. Like, you know, I don't like smoking at all. I don't like, you know, I think if you're really looking for optimum performance, you got to do the right things, and that goes into all the recovery pieces. Yeah, you got to eat well. You got to do this. I guess the best part I pulled from that story is, you know, during the time that was part of the culture, whatever. That was in the 70s and 80s. Not big deal. But what I pulled from it was the mental tenacity of, like you talked about, these guys, they'd go out and party all night. They'd come in and beat each other's brains in for
yep.
And there's a part of, I definitely believe you have to use the real recovery methods. Your sleep, your food, your supplements, all that stuff is extremely important. But I think what hurts you is if you use it as a crutch, and you could only, I see guys that they got to go over and turn on their song before they go lift. And they got to I got to get my pre-workout in. Hey, I agree. Yeah. All that stuff's good. But if that keeps you, and that's what Dad always laughs about. He's like, man, if you know, talking about all the little 20-year-olds and stuff in the gym, if you got to listen to so-and-so song or take your pre-workout in order to push yourself hard today, you know, leave the gym for a while. Go see what real hard is. And you know, then come back when your mindset's a little bit better. So I agree. I think sometimes people use the recovery too much as a crutch, in that they have to have it. I see it as, use it, every ounce of it, if you got it. But if you don't, hey, well, that's where you're at that day.
Let me ask you this: when you were really in the thick of the Highlands, if we could just pick one thing for recovery, what do you think that would have been? If you had, say, I was your student right now, and we could only, like, I do this with everybody. I'll even ask you this after. If I asked you and I said, Coach, what if you had to tell me one thing to do for recovery, it would be?
I hate to say it, one thing. The stuff I think I was doing better than most of the other athletes was the recovery side. And my big thing was like a stick or some kind of myofascial release that I would always take with me when I traveled.
Yep.
I would work out the morning before the games if I could, which was contraindicated of what a lot of people thought. And it was, and when I talk about workout, it wasn't like it wasn't like an hour long. It was 10 to 15 minutes of a general warm up, and that got everything dialed in and ready to go, so I could attack harder and faster than everyone else could that morning.
Yeah,
and that was more of a prep, and I learned that from Andy Bloom and Adam Setliff.
discus throwers on the circuit. And the last thing I would say, which was the one that's really, you know, it gets a lot more traction now, but 7-8 years ago wasn't as popular, was the contrast showers.
Okay. And hot and cold.
Hot, cold. Yep. And the way to do it, what I learned was the hot, cold, obviously. But if you are about to go to bed, if you're doing it before the evening, you end on warm. Where your body is cooling down, and as your body's cooling down, hormones are released that make you want to go to sleep.
Yep.
So that was how you do that. And then in the morning, you end with cool, which makes your body work to try to build up that heat and get you ready. So I would do the contrast in the morning and the evening, and that was a way that I reset the system that I think I was recovering better than some of the people I was competing against and was able to get the training volume in, get the strength work in, and be able to hang with guys that were 6'5", 320 pounds when I was weighing 240. That was, I think, my training and my mindset were the only two things that even kept me in the game as a thrower, because physically I was pretty far behind the eight ball.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I did that last year when John Brookfield wrote, it was a while ago, he wrote an article about, you know, dumping cold water on you. And I had read stuff with Russians, and there was one guy I remember reading it. I thought it was nuts. He had like a little pond in his backyard that froze over. He cut a chunk of ice out of it and would stand in it, okay?
Yep.
So what I did is I started doing it in October. They'd use two. I'd use one. 5-gallon bucket of water, start dumping it over my head, right, you know, first thing in the morning. And I'll tell you, the first few times you thought, you're like, whoa, you know, it's like brain freeze, you know. But I continued that. I did one winter of that. I'm going to start doing that again this year. And I'll tell you what, I don't get sick very much. I didn't get nothing that way.
Really?
And I was around, you know, I've got nieces and nephews. Or, you know, kids are always sick with school and all that stuff. What I think, too, I mean, we're up here in upstate, so we usually get some harsh winters. We had one last year, but it's been mixed. I'll tell you this, I like Iceland so much, I could be very motivated to move there down the road permanently. I like cold weather. I'm a cold weather animal. There's no doubt about it. I like the heat. I've lived in warm weather. But if I had my choice, zero would be where I am.
Nice.
Yeah, I feel a lot healthier, too. I don't know what it is. I just... You know, like we had a little cold shot of air last night because we've gotten some pretty bad storms here up in, you know, New York. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like having the air conditioning off. I just like having that nice breeze coming in at night, you know. It feels real good like that. So, or, you know, you hit on a big thing. That plays a big part. And, you know, I mean, you know, we definitely want to have you back. I'd like to do a thing we were talking about. We'd get into recovery. I mean, I know we can do a show on recovery, too.
Sure.
We're almost into an hour right now. I mean, is there anything you need to finish off, Bert? Do you want?
I was just thinking, actually, your question has posed this about the one thing in recovery. I think it's the thing that no one's really thinking about is the mental recovery and time away from the sport. If I think back in 2001 when I made my biggest jump in the hammer, I look back on my training log, and the funny thing was is the weeks that I had really good throws, I went fishing that week sometime. As stupid as that sounds, and I started seeing a pattern that and all it was I was doing something that I was turning off my brain from throwing. I wasn't stressing about it. I was relaxing. I was resting. I was doing something I enjoyed. I was getting my serotonin levels and everything back up where I was enjoying life, and I didn't see the sport as a job. And to the point where I literally in 2001 at the Eugene at Track and Field Nationals in Eugene, Oregon, 2 days before I competed, Jay Harvard and I drove up into the mountains. We went swimming in an ice-cold stream, and we fished for trout for a couple hours. And everyone was going, you're going to be out in the sun. You're going to get drained. Yeah. You're going to be out. There's no way that you're going to blah, 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 this and that. First throw, lifetime best.
There you go.
And I was enjoying my time, man. I was hanging out with a buddy, swimming in some cold water, fishing because I like doing that. And I was completely at a relaxation state. I wasn't stressing about the competition. I was enjoying life, and I went out there and got the job done.
Well, you know, there's such a thing as called diversion, and it works all the time. And, you know, like you said, you hit the perfect note. It's like it's no longer a job. And, it, you know, you got to take it serious, but if you're going to put that type of mental pressure on you all the time, that's going to reflect physically, obviously, and you're going to start slipping.
Yep.
And then you're going to be scratching your head and saying, okay, what do I do? And then you go and try to change everything. You see this with so many athletes. It's like, you can't keep reinventing yourself. It comes down to this. You know, like I used to like what Bob Hoffman wrote. I can't say it verbatim, but it was like this. You know, mentally we're talking now. If you give out mentally, you're finished anyways. You know, we know that. But the thing I used to love, he'd write about boxers or football players or anybody like that. Here's another thing. You know, he was always a big guy. Take good care of your legs, because once your legs go, you're done as an athlete, you know. And I always that always kind of rang in my ears too. It's like it's not only the mental game, and the mental game pretty much runs everything, but there's certain areas, especially on a male, that you know you got to be very strong with. You know, the loins, the legs, all that stuff. And it's like once those components go on you, and that's happened to friends of mine that for one reason or another, they stopped lifting. You know, it might have been family, kids, et cetera, et cetera. My thing is this. If you get out of the game like that totally, a lot of times you're never going to come back. And if you come back, you're not going to be anything of what you were. And maybe you don't want to be at that point. But wouldn't it be wise when you've got that much skin in a game? And I know people have, you know, I know busy lives. I know how it is now. It's worse than ever. But wouldn't it be still smart, you know, we're talking physical culture, you couldn't go down once a week and squat for 15 minutes?
Right.
Or you couldn't go down. See, once you pull out, I think it's such a mental game, especially at levels like where you're at with a stone lifting, anything like that. If you don't have that mental, we'll use the word tenacity again, but you've got to really have balls, literally.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes on you. If you're not practicing, you know, think about anything that you're good at. It could be from homemaker to doctor to lawyer. You get out of the game for a year or two. I don't care.
Call it a career at that point.
That's it.
Yep.
And you can be one of the best athletes, individuals, or whatever you are in your chosen field, but you lose something, you know. And that's why I always say to people, like my mother's in her 60s, and I always say to her, this is no time to slow down. You should speed up.
Yeah.
Because if you slow down, well, how many people do we see that retire and within a year they're in a box?
Exactly.
Okay, so, you know, why don't we do this? I mean, I'll talk to you off the air when we're done here. Why don't we give out all your information to, obviously, SoarinX and your Facebook or anything else you're connected to socially, your website. Why don't we get that? I'll put mine out there. We'll end the show, and we'll, you know, we'd love to have you back on. This was a great interview. I mean, we didn't even probably get anywhere near what we wanted to, but there's a lot of good information. It's fun to talk to guys that, you know about the older athletes and show a respect for them because, you know, you got to look what came, you know, in front of you. I mean, I wouldn't know half the stuff I know if it wasn't for reading books and you know, learning about these big individuals. So, Bert, give us all, you know, anything you want to give motivation and muscle out there and take it away.
Gotcha. Okay, well, you could reach me at SoarinX.com, SoRinEX. That's my website. You could email me at Bert, BERT, at SoarinX.com. Check out our Facebook page. I'm on Twitter. I believe we have Instagram. We've been around for a long time, so we should be able to be pretty easy to find. And one thing I will say from a motivational side, just real quick, and I'd like to go into it next time we talk.
Shoot it.
You know, I call it change the letter. And it was a big time in my training life when, like you were saying, how it becomes a job and you start overthinking it and you start putting too much pressure. And And I would always say, oh, I got to train today. Well, I got to go throw today. I got to do this. I got to do that. And then finally one day I said, you know what? I don't got to do anything. I don't got to squat today. I don't got to throw today. No one's holding a gun to my head making me do this. Right. I would like to. I enjoy doing it. And so I changed the letter from – I changed the O to an E. Instead of got to, I get to. Mm-hmm. And it literally became, hey, I get to go squat today. I get to throw today. And that the training itself became an award, a reward for me. If I got all my things done business-wise, socially, family, and everything, if I was on my game enough that day to get it all done, then I got – my reward was I got to go throw. I was able to go throw. I get to go do this. And when that changed – the pressure released from my mind of what my sport was, and my sport became fun again. It became a reward, and yep. My results started climbing like crazy. But I had to stay in that mindset, or all of a sudden it becomes a burden.
Well, this is why we call the show Motivation and Muscle. Okay, this was one of my big things. Because of the motivation to do it. And I'll tell you why I'm motivated, and I always will be, regardless what happens to me physically. I'll go quick with this. The site is dedicated to my brother Jimmy, who had muscular dystrophy and died from it, all right? I don't know if – I hope you never have that around your family or friends. It's an awful thing to see that, you know, by you're like 10 years old, you're wheelchair-bound and – you know, as a young teenager, you pass away. And, you know, my brothers and sister, we were all into some form of, you know, whether it's weights or karate or whatever, because something like that will touch you forever. But the point is, even when I feel crappy, I mean, you know, look, I know enough to take an extra day or whatever, but nothing is ever going to be as bad as what he dealt with. And I'm like, you know what? So what, I got a little nick here or whatever. I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit and complain about it, because I'll tell you something. This is what always amazed me about watching Jim. Jim never had any problem mentally, anything. My parents would not do, you know, he was matriculated in school. We'd take him everywhere. And I'll tell you what, Bert, when you look over at this kid, watching everybody play, organized baseball, we were all in the sports all the time. And he's always got a smile on his face. And I'm sitting there, you know, I'd stand there some days, and I still think about it. And I'm like, how the hell could he sit in that wheelchair and even smile?
Right.
Never heard him complain, nothing. And it's like, how dare I even say I've got this or that? You know what I mean? All right, you know how to fix it? If you had to have it fixed surgically, like with the arm, well, so be it. You know what I mean? But it's like, you know, I always tell people, and I'm not a big preachy guy, and I don't get into this a lot with people, but it's like, you know what? You know how lucky you are to be able to put your feet down on the floor when you get out of bed in the morning?
Absolutely.
I mean, think about that,
absolutely.
All right? So, you know, we're very blessed as men here and everybody else in this sport that whether you're competitive or not anymore or whatever you're doing with it, you know, we've had a great opportunity here.
Yeah.
And we have a chance here. Now, you have children. Obviously, I'm sure they're interested. If not, they will be. You got a chance not only as a parent to make a mark on them, but, you know, as my brother Mark said to me a few weeks ago when he was over, if we've done anything right in our life, I'll tell you what, lifting was it, man. And that's the truth, and I'll tell you why. Because, like we were talking, what the hell would we do if something ever happened? I was like, I think I'd fall off a cliff accidentally. I mean, look, this is such a big party, and, you know, I don't ever want to think about the other thing, but there will come a time probably. But I am hoping, you know, I'm in my 80s and I can still press like John Grimmick and still squat like John Grimmick. And then, you know, if they say to me, it's all over, Eric, I'm just like, okay, I'm in heaven now. You know what I mean? It's like, I did what I did. I hope I made a mark on people. I hope with all the stuff we're doing now with the business, really helps a lot of people, and I can earn a good living that way, because that's my plan. So that's pretty much it with me, other than me giving out the web stuff. Do you got anything you'd like to part with there, Chief?
Nah, man, that was awesome. I appreciate that
motivation, that's all right,
piece that you shared with me. That's that gets me fired up for the day too, man. You're exactly right. We have so little to complain about. I know probably both of us do at times.
Oh, of course.
But, you know, it probably the reality is if anyone's listening to this right now, you're much richer than most of the population because you're listening to it on a computer in somewhere that's probably air conditioned and you're not fighting, you know, a gorilla for your food right now. So
exactly. And you know something, it's just like this stuff's a lot of fun. And what I want to do is I want to get as many people into it and interested as possible because we are at it. We are at a dilemma right now, especially the young kids, when you got 30% obesity in the entire world. I can't even wrap my arms around that because, you know, always on the go, we always were, you know, it's a different world. But you know something, people like us with the message, and you know, you manufacture things and you're involved same way as I am, you know, if we could touch 2 out of 10, that's huge, man.
Absolutely.
1 out of 10 even, and that's the plan. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give our stuff out. So, number one, this is Motivation and Muscle, the podcast show that connects your brain to your brawn. We are sponsored by Fiorello Barbell Company. That's www.fiorellobarbellco.com. We are on Facebook. We're at Twitter at Fiorello.Eric. Or no, it's Fiorello Eric. I'm sorry. We are on Stitcher and iTunes, and I'll tell Bert, just like I tell everybody, he and I are famous again today. We're going to be heard by millions, and Motivation Muscle is being listened to out of the United States because I have stats that I look at every few days. Let me think. Well, Motivation Muscle is going off by itself, but that's a whole other thing. We're going to be talking tomorrow morning about that. It's in the process right now. And, of course, we've got The Weight is Over Fast, which is going to be one heck of a weight loss product that it's going to answer more to the working man and woman. It's not going to be somebody laying on a beach, I can tell you that.
There you go.
But when you see a guy lose 43 pounds in 6 months that had a belly on him like he was pregnant and was, they thought, possibly pre-diabetic, and you see him go from 267 to 224. We beat it by a pound, and right now it's close to a year later. He's holding at 222, which is even less. And now we're going to take Dennis, and we're going to bring him up to about 229 pounds for Christmas. So wait till you see what we're going to do with this guy. It's pretty fun. I already got him running hills, doing a few other things, but when he comes over here, Bert, you'll be interested in this. Going to do a few flashier things for his arms, but I'm going to attain all this size from him lifting stones.
Nice.
So when you see this video, this is going to be good. Plus, I'm going to be working with him because I'm going to be training for Iceland. So we're going to kind of have a double-decker here. So it'll be interesting. So I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure, sir. I got to tell
you, Eric, it's been a great time. Hopefully I'll get invited again so we get to talk some more.
You'll get invited. I want to, you know, we can talk about a lot of subjects, and I'd love to have you on. I mean, we need to have people like you that are resources, you know, and can convey a message. You know, it's a gift to be able to tell, you know, talk to people. And I don't care what anybody tells you. If you can communicate, you can get places in the world. So, you know, look, we'll sign off for today. And I'll talk to you off the air, and we'll make some plans. So for Bert Soren, this is Eric Fiorello. You know, tune into the other Motivation and Muscles. We finally got them all up when I started and doing them by myself in the end of May of this year. So have a good week, and we'll be talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for listening to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast that connected your brain to your brawn. We'll see you next time.